Every day we've gone forward in time since about early 2022, borrowers in the mortgage market have refinanced and or, you know, into higher interest rate regimes. And that's been persistent for, what, 3-4 years now. And so the issue is that if the Fed continues to maintain this kind of structurally tight monetary policy because they're hyper-focused on this arbitrary 2% inflation target, ultimately, we're not getting the kind of credit relief to the consumers and businesses trapped on the bottom part of the K. It's the same in the credit market as well. In terms of the refinancing risk, it's been persistently positive for years now. And so this is an economy that's sort of like, you know, fiscal dominance is essentially an economy whereby it can't go into recession because of fiscal dominance. But the flip side of that positive outcome, the negative side of that outcome is that we have these, you know, very K-shaped outcomes. There's just not enough money going to consumers and businesses at the bottom part of the K. And that's why interest rates are so high. There's just the treasury is too big. It's gobbling up too much capital. And so if the Fed doesn't play ball in terms of making that process easier to digest for financial markets, then there won't be any capital left to get to the consumers and businesses on the bottom part of K, which is why these interest rates are so high.
Hello, and welcome back to Raise Your Average. I'm your host, Pierre Daly. Co-hosting with me is Mike Philbrick, CEO at Resolve Asset Management Global, and Adam Butler, CIO at Resolve Asset Management Global. Mike, Adam.
Good to see you.
Guys, we have got a terrific guest joining us today, one of our favorites, and definitely one of the best and most highly regarded in his field. If markets are a storm, Darius Dale is the guy you want reading the weather. Founder and CEO of 42 Macro LLC, he's built a reputation on stripping emotion from the equation and letting the data speak. Today, his macroeconomic read isn't just sharp, it's surgical, helping investors navigate the economic cycle, manage risk like pros, and construct portfolios that can stand up to whatever the market throws next.
This is Raise Your Average, dedicated to making you a better long-term investor. Join us as we sit down with some of the most interesting names in finance to discuss macro, markets, investment strategies, and more.
Darius, welcome. It is terrific to see you again and have you on.
Yeah, thanks so much for the too kind introduction. I don't know if my team paid you to say all that, but I appreciate it, man. Thanks for having me on, Mike, Adam. It's great to be back with you guys. We always had some really good discussions back in the day, so I'm super pumped for this.
Yeah, it's always exciting to have you on, man. I mean, you really are the most data-driven guy on Wall Street these days, or off Wall Street these days. And, you know, it's before we get into your like 1,400 slides, I'm sure you're going to share with us here today. I've been really admiring the way that you have been framing your mission these days, right? You frame it in your videos. You're on track every day with great content. You got clear eyes about what you're trying to do out there. And I want to give you a chance to spend kind of whatever, 60, 90 seconds on your broader mission before we get into the deck that I know is the bulk of the value today.
No, look, I appreciate you saying that. And, you know, I'm a very mission-oriented person, especially in today's modern times. You know, I feel like we're living through a very K-shaped period of time with regards to the outcomes families are feeling across the country and world. And as someone who grew up at the very bottom of that K, I realized, you know, a long way into my career that I wasn't doing anything to help the people that I left behind. I spent the first 12 years of my career on Wall Street making rich people richer. And, you know, it finally just hit me that, you know, I'm not really, like I said, I'm not really doing anything for the folks that I left behind. So I quit my former life on Wall Street, you know, flying around the world, meeting with PMs and CIOs and consulting them on macro risk management to start 42 Macro, which does all the same things from a macro risk manager perspective in terms of keeping people on the right side of risk, helping people understand where we are in the growth, inflation cycles, policy, all that kind of stuff, you know, the stuff that our institutional clients, you know, continue to collaborate with me on. But what we decided to do that was very different than most firms of any firm on Wall Street, which is we sell the exact same content to investors all across the spectrum at price points that retail investors can afford. So
I think from what I can tell, we're probably the only people selling top flight macro risk management content that being used by, you know, a cumulative $25+ trillion worth of AUM in terms of our buy side clients, that those same signals, that same information, those same slide decks, those same everything is coming to the inboxes of thousands of retail investors all around the world at price points that they can afford. And this is my way of giving back and trying to create some positive outcomes for society. So really blessed to be on this mission, and it's gone really well. So thanks for giving me the opportunity to embellish.
Love it.
Yeah.
Love it.
Thank you.
Before we get into your 8,000 slides, I wouldn't mind you
8,021.
Oh, no. We are. I would, great letter to the Fed Chairman Powell, by the way. But I wouldn't mind you setting the table a little bit on some of the misconceptions about tariffs, their potential impact on growth and inflation, some of the things about this growth-led debt normalization that people are kind of misconstruing, and how that's going to relate to it, and how it relates to some of the policy mistakes that are being made that you've talked about as well, and maybe set the table a little bit before we dig into, you know, here are the findings. Let's set the table and refocus the lens for folks, because there seems to be a lot of misconception out there about what is actually happening under the hood here. And I think if we can set that table, we can really get into the presentation is going to have more meaningful impact.
100%. And boy, if there was ever a year to be a data-driven macro risk manager, it was 2025. Because not only we had a very quick bear market, and then one of, I think it was the most vicious recovery of a bear market, I think, in history, in terms of the speed of time was true, recaptured the previous high. So in terms of setting the table, you know, we've been coaching our clients and folks in our community this year to think about the world in three different paradigms. Paradigm A, and the reason for that is because, to your point, Mike, there's so much stuff going on. Like, I've never in my life worked this hard just to stay abreast of what's going on, let alone like project what might be going on in the future. It's just so many cross currents from a macroeconomic standpoint and a policymaking standpoint. And this is to be expected. This is something we've been guiding our clients to for the past couple of years since we introduced our investing doing a four turning regime framework and all the research that supported that, which is essentially to say, hey, if you're an investor, you need to stop thinking about a distribution of probable economic outcomes that looks like this and start thinking about a distribution of probable outcomes that looks something like this. And the delta between, you know, what people think is a normal kind of set of circumstances from a growth, inflation, policy, positioning standpoint, and what's likely to occur in a four turning, you know, the tails are just much fatter. We have the widest distribution of probable economic and policy outcomes that pretty much every investor has ever seen, because the last time it was this wide was in the previous four turning. And I don't think anybody was trading risk. And so that sort of starting point allowed us to sort of say, hey, let's think outside, because the distribution of probable economic and policy outcomes is so wide, it's going to be almost impossible to do what we normally do as investors, which is, okay, I'm going to predict GDP and predict inflation and, you know, front run the Fed policy meeting and predict the jobs report and, you know, and or get, you know, NVIDIA earning, you know, like these little small things in the context of a four turning are going to become less relevant. And what's more relevant is understanding the change, the big changes, the institutional changes that are taking place. And so that's where our paradigm framework comes from. Paradigm A is where we were coming from, which is sort of the fiscal dominance regime of Biden's economy. It's, you know, I would say the net result was we probably got an economy that was running hot. We had a tremendous amount of crowding out for consumers and businesses on the bottom part of that K-shaped economy as a function of the fiscal dominance of the higher interest rate regime that we that catalyzed. And ultimately, we're sort of left with these record non-war, non-recession budget deficits that are likely to require some form of the Fed playing ball, but they weren't exactly playing ball. So that was sort of paradigm A. Paradigm B, which is what we thought the administration was elected and given a very popular mandate to address, or to push the economy to, which is, okay, how do we transition the economy from being driven by fiscal largesse with quite a bit of support from monetary largesse, at least early on in that process, to an economy that's driven by private sector innovation and development and productivity growth. That requires obviously shrinking the government substantially so that you can return all that capital back to the private sector and put it to more quote unquote productive uses. I mean, I think, you know, obviously we all know the
the multiplier on private uses of capital is higher than government. Public uses of capital tends to be, generally speaking. That was what we thought the administration was got elected to do, to usher in paradigm B. Now, the problem with paradigm B, from the starting point of an all-time high in the market and a non-recession, but yet a sluggish economy that had yet to go into recession, is, hey, if they actually started to cut the federal budget deficit by a significant degree, we're going to have some problems, both in the economy and asset markets. And so that allowed us to ultimately anticipate a kitchen sinking of the economy and asset markets early in the administration's tenure. So that was obviously true for a while. But what happened on April 9th was, in our opinion, the most important thing we've seen in financial markets since Lehman Brothers were bankrupt, which is the bond market essentially blew up as a function of trying to transition to paradigm B. And so, in my opinion, I think that was a pretty clear signal from the global capital allocators that, hey, we've given you a lot of money to grow a lot, to grow very fast, the United States of America. And if you stop growing very fast for any reason, we're going to take our money and go home and reinvest it elsewhere. And that process, that capital outflow process, in my opinion, I think risked two things that were incredibly hazardous to the administration's, you know, political prospects, et cetera. One, it would have risked a durable loss of U.S. exceptionalism. And I will explain all this, the charts, sort of for trials I take. It would have risked a durable loss of U.S. exceptionalism. And worse, it could have risked a potential debt spiral in the context of the cost of our capital starting to rise, both from an equity and credit perspective, sovereign credit perspective. And so that, in our opinion, is why the administration pivoted to paradigm C on April 9th. Paradigm C is, okay, we can't cut our way out of the problem, because if we cut our way out of the problem and the economy goes into recession, then they're going to take their money and go home, our foreign creditors, including from the treasury market in a recession. We learned that in April of this year. And that's why I say it was such a big event in terms of being the biggest event we've seen since Lehman Brothers. We learned that a recession is bearish for treasuries in April of 2025, not bullish. And so the administration learned that as well. And so we think that as a function of that, they pivot us away from the kind of paradigm B Doge angle to, okay, let's just try to outgrow the debt problem. Let's just try to outgrow these deficits and try to reduce our, you know, kind of country risk, if you will, our sovereign country risk, if you will, as by outgrowing the problem. And so we are now, in our opinion, very clearly mired in paradigm C, which features a lot of the fiscal largesse that we saw for paradigm A. It's more than likely to see increasing degrees of monetary largesse. We're not there yet, but in our opinion, that's coming. We're likely to see substantial deregulation across industries, most notably the financial sector, which touches every industry in the economy. We're going to see some reshoring, some manufacturing building, not a ton. Obviously, the tariff regime isn't high enough to catalyze that, and I don't think they want to, given the risk of returning to paradigm B, what that would mean for asset markets and the economy. And so ultimately, you have this situation where we think we have a pretty high conviction view, and have had since late April, that the administration is in paradigm C. We're not going back to paradigm B. So the left tail risk from the perspective of asset markets is greatly diminished. And that's why we've been so bullish after having called for the crash earlier this year. So that's kind of the table. We can unpack any of that that's most interesting for you guys, if you want.
Well, you've been calling the current setup paradigm C, fiscal dominance, deregulation, coordinated support. You even said this could push equities to new all-time highs by year end, right? That's a strong call, Darius, especially with all the noise out there about slowdown risks.
Well, that was the call from early May, by the way.
Yeah.
We're at all-time high.
Yeah. We're there, right? Looking
into the devil's eyes, he said that.
the devil's never lined up across me with a three.
Right. So where are we now, Darius? In paradigm C, where are we now? Because, you know, the fiscal dominance versus monetary dominance story has played out. I mean, it's crossed the wire quite a bit in the recent months, and you know, the Trump Powell feud continues. Right. Where do we go from here? What does your data tell you? What's happening?
Well, I appreciate you asking in those terms, because ultimately it's always going to come down to the data. Like one of the things that I think it's served me very well in my career, obviously, but it's a labor of intense love I personally bean count every relevant economic statistic that is published from all the 10 major economies in the world.
And the reason I do that, it's much like any PM or analyst that has a coverage universe. They're going to be on every earnings call from every company in their coverage universe. They're not skipping earnings calls, right? At the bare minimum, they're getting summaries and recaps and updating their models that way. I sort of had that ethos from having started my career very early in my career as a retail analyst on the equity side. I hated it, obviously, and wound up on the macro team and back to be enjoying the macro team. But I guess I learned that skill of, every single one of these data points matters. You don't know which one it's going to be, but it could matter. And so I have that sort of ethos of, okay, if it comes out, I have to analyze it and contextualize it for myself and for our clients. And yesterday afternoon, in terms of answering your question, we got the monthly treasury budget statement. The July monthly treasury budget statement. So as a potential checkup on where are we in this fiscal dominance regime. And the reality is fiscal dominance continues unabated. And this is something that we have been calling for and is likely to continue. It's very unlikely that we see a significant fiscal retrenchment after what we observed in early April, because ultimately you're talking about a durable loss of U.S. exceptionalism and a potential debt spiral. No administration is going to elect for those outcomes when the alternative is either grow your way out of the problem or print your way out of the problem. Right. I mean, that's cut, grow, or print. So they realize cutting is going to be the worst possible outcome. So it's very unlikely that they go down that route. And so in terms of the data we got yesterday, so if you analyze the annualize the nominal fiscal year to date budget, the budget deficit is currently tracking at $1.95 trillion. That's up $122 billion year over year. So the budget deficit is still growing despite tariff revenue growing. Where we at? Tariff revenues more than doubled year over year at 111%. And it's going to continue to go higher, obviously. It may even double from here before the fiscal year is over, certainly before the calendar year is over. But the reality is we continue to live in a world whereby the budget deficits get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. It was up $137 billion in fiscal year 2024. It was up $320 billion in fiscal 2023. And part of the reason it continues to get bigger and bigger and bigger is not necessarily from, clever policies or non-defense discretionary spending. In fact, if you cut out all non-defense discretionary spending and flowed all of the savings down to the bottom line with no impact, net impact on tax receipts or the economy, you would still wind up with a 5% budget deficit to GDP as opposed to 6% currently. And so what's driving the budget deficit? Like, why do we continue to have bigger and bigger and bigger budget deficits? And it's the stuff that they won't touch that are the politically protected categories. I'm sure you guys know Lou Grohman, our friend Lou Grohman from Forest of the Trees. Brilliant, big fan of his. He's got this metric called true interest expense, which is Medicare, national defense, net interest, and Social Security. When you add those four categories up, you wind up with about $4.5 trillion in spending on a base of about 7.1. So it's about 63% of total spending, 15% of GDP. And it grew $277 billion in 2022. $460-something billion in 2023, $409 billion in 2024, $393 billion in 2025. So that's a trailing three-year CAGR of 12%. And then when you layer on Medicaid, which is, allegedly going to start being cut in 2029, if they ever get around to it, they may kick that can down the road again like they did with the expiration of the Trump tax cuts, depending on whose office. When you layer on Medicaid, you're talking about a trailing three-year CAGR on 76% of the federal expenditures. So think about the kind of cutting you would have to do to offset that. You would have to have some very draconian cuts on other programs or some very draconian tax hikes, neither of which do we see any real meaningful will in Congress to enact those outcomes. So we know we're still in this fiscal dominance regime. We know the drivers of fiscal dominance are, very clearly categories that are not going to be touched. And we also have a significant amount of tax relief on the horizon. If you look at next year, the one big omnibus bill that was recently passed in July, the tax cuts and the incremental spending, whether it be national defense, border spending, all that kind of stuff, that stuff's front end loaded. The savings are back end loaded. So for the next 2 years, at least 2 to 3 years, we're going to have peak positive fiscal impulse in terms of incrementally growing the budget deficit on top of what we're already seeing. Now, obviously, tariffs are an offset to some of that. You're talking about raising $350 billion of a tariff revenue we're going to get to somewhere around $350 billion of tariff revenue at some point in the next 12 months on a year-over-year basis. And so that is a pinch, but it's not the kind of fiscal retrenchment in the context of all these other dynamics that I think was a risk to the economy. And so ultimately what that means, where we're going to wind up is a situation where the Fed is going to be forced to play ball in a fiscal dominance regime era. We have the high conviction view that the Fed's central bank independence is going to be increasingly eroded over time. And this is consistent with what previous returnings. It's also just consistent with what happens when you're talking about a sovereign that gets too indebted. Right now, we're at 100%+ of GDP. We're at 117% of our domestic liquidity. So we can't even capitalize our own bond market with our domestic savings here. We now have to beg our neighbors for just to plug our holes in our bond market. So we are sort of at the mercy of both foreign creditors. We're also increasingly at the mercy of investors who demand ex ante units of return for the risk that they take in their portfolios, meaning that they're going to be unwilling to buy treasuries past certain levels, which ultimately means someone, you, Mr. Powell, or whoever replaces you, is going to be increasingly forced to support the treasury market on an ongoing basis. And so this is one of my favorite charts here to help investors contextualize the ultimate upside risks we see in asset markets as a function of the Fed being forced into participating in paradigm C. So this chart shows the floor Fed funds rate. That's the minimum value on the overnight index swap curve about 2 years. So it's at 3%. If you deflate that by the 2 year TIPS break even, you wind up with, you know, 42 basis points. So let's call that 50 basis points for simplicity's sake. We think by the end of next year, there will be enough forward guidance in the marketplace for the real Fed funds rate, which is currently at 50+ 50 basis points, to decline to -50 basis points. Doesn't mean the Fed funds rate will be -50 basis points on a real basis. It just means that from that point forward, markets will be anticipating, you know, an increasing erosion of Fed independence and more persistent support with its fiscal dominance regime. In my opinion, that represents a significant upside risk for asset markets.
There is exactly. Can I cross pause quickly and ask you to just sort of dig into the idea of domestic liquidity for me? You mentioned 117% number or something. And the ability of the domestic market to absorb treasury issuance. Can you say a bit more about that?
Yeah, 100%. So what I meant by that is when you look, take our stock of public sector debt outstanding, U.S. public sector debt outstanding, we're at 117% of our domestic liquidity. And so how we calculate liquidity globally, we look at the aggregated central bank balance sheets, global broad money supply, and global FX reserves minus gold. If you just think about intuitively, these are the three pools of capital that can be used to capitalize assets. We have, you know, money is debt, or debt is money in terms of capitalizing assets. Obviously, if central bank balance sheets, they can use their balance sheet to capitalize asset markets. And then you obviously have recycling from foreign reserve managers. And so when you break that apart into each independent economy, so the U.S. economy has its own liquidity that feeds into our global liquidity proxy. Let me try to see what that statistic is. Yeah, that statistic is it's about $29 trillion of liquidity. And so we're currently trending higher, so that's good, but we're not trending higher and keeping pace with the growth of the treasury market. Budget deficits are growing faster than our liquidity. And so now we are well north of 100%. And so that ultimately means we need foreign participation to capitalize our treasury market. Right now, I want to say foreign creditors own about 32% of all marketable treasury securities outstanding. Europe's at 6%, Japan's at 4%, China's at 3%, the UK's at 3%. So a little bit, you know, close to half, about half of treasury market there represented there. And the problem, in our opinion, one of the big problems and one of the things we identified in our investing in a fourth turning regime framework a couple of years ago was that, hey, in four turnings, the sharpness of elbows get really sharp in four turns. You tend to see a breakdown of international cooperation. You see tendency of breakdown of trade, and you ultimately see kind of enough populism and general sharp elbowedness that leads to total war. In fact, every four turnings since the 1400s has resulted in total war. And so, obviously I'm not smart enough to predict something like a total war, but I am cognizant of these risks enough to say, hey, when you think about what's happening from Europe, NATO taking their defense budgets to 5% of GDP from 2% currently. Like right now, 2% is like not even on the 5%, not even on the axis. Most of these countries are barely at 2% from their 2024 spending. They're not going to be at 5% in 2035, which is the target. But we know all the numbers are going to go up. So what that represents is a capital call for their debt. You know, you think about Japan; they're continuing to policy normalize. One of the most under talked about dynamics in all of global macro is the fact that Japan has sustainably, incredibly escaped deflation. You know, they've been above target on inflation for 3 years now. So it's unlikely that they're, you know, we think they've credibly escaped deflation. And because of that, you know, Japan's policy rate, which is currently 50 basis points, has a lot of upside risk. from here.
So it seems like there's natural players who have traditionally absorbed U.S. Treasury issuance. Many of those players are now needing to fund their own accelerated fiscal deficits, right?
Yeah.
So that's less capital that would naturally, all things equal, be available to fund U.S. fiscal deficits, right? What about the U.S. domestic financial sector? Typically, you know, if you go back to sort of the 50s, for example, with the financial repression, then the banks and insurance companies domestically were called upon, not just in the U.S., but in most of the allied countries, to fund deficits at a loss. Do you see that coming as well?
100%. It has to come. It's one of the things that has to happen to overcome these headwinds. So the answer is yes. You forgot China. Don't forget, we're strategically decoupling from China.
Right.
You know, one of the world's most obnoxious divorce processes of all time. And what's different about this strategic coupling is, like, we used to be strategically decoupling from China. Now they're choosing to strategically decouple from us alongside us. So both economies, if you look at imports from China, U.S. imports from China were now down at 7% from the high of mid-20s. You look at our Chinese exports to the U.S. As a percent of total, we're now down 11% from a high in the mid-20s. Both countries can't decouple fast enough, in their opinion. Obviously, they don't want to crash their own respective economies. But the reality is, our three largest foreign creditors are moving in the wrong direction. So we need institutions domestically to step up and take some of the heat. So if you look at U.S. commercial banks, they own about 16% of all marketable treasury securities outstanding. When you go back and you look at the share of commercial bank assets that was allocated to the treasury market in the last four turnings, so in the 1940s, it was 50%.
Yeah.
So right. 16 can go to 50%. And so we know we're going to continue to see some forms of financial disruption that increased banks' ability to capitalize the treasury market over a long-term time horizon. It's not going to happen, you know, every month or every quarter or every year, but over a long-term time horizon, that's coming. They're going to relax the SLR. They've explicitly told us they're relaxing the SLR to, you know, we'll ameliorate some quote-unquote stress in the treasury market. They're going to do other things. So we know that's coming. But ultimately, the only institution in the world with a balance sheet that's large and flexible enough to plug this fourth turning size demand hole in the treasury market is the Fed. And so this is why we've been pounding the table for years that, hey, we need regime change at the Fed, or we're going to be stuck with this K-shaped, you know, top-heavy economy whereby an increasingly small share of consumers and businesses are actually winning and an increasingly large share of consumers and businesses are losing. Like right now, if you look at the USK, you know, from an economic demand perspective, you know, it's not balanced. The people on the top part of the K are much larger than the people on the bottom part of the K, the consumers and businesses on the bottom part of the K, in terms of their impact on the economy. For example, if you look at the top third of consumers by income cohort, they're about 51% of total consumer spending, whereby the bottom third is about 15%. So obviously, it's already incredibly K-shaped to begin with. And so this is the kind of outcome that we're trying to, use my platform to avoid. It's only going to get worse over time if the Fed allows the treasury market to continue crowding out the economy.
So I don't want to go too far down this road, but I am curious how you perceive the causal chain playing out, whereby the Fed reorienting and becoming an active participant in the debt monetization agenda is expected to help those at the bottom end of the income distribution relative to where we are today.
Well, I'll tell you the smart way to do it, and I'll tell you the way we're currently doing it right now. The way we're currently doing it right now is act like it doesn't exist and potentially send the economy into recession because we're myopically focused on a 2% inflation target.
The recession obviously clearly hurts those at the bottom a lot more than those at the top. So that's a fair point.
Well, it's even worse than that. It's the Fed is anchoring on this arbitrary, and an impasse is on arbitrary, 2% inflation target for God knows what reason. We're in a structurally inflationary time. Our second inflation model since January of 2022 has signaled that the equilibrium core PCE rate, which would be the horizontal line in this diagram, is somewhere in the high twos or low threes. It varies, it fluctuates. But it's saying that, hey, this is an economy that just structurally wants to run high twos, low threes inflation. If you maintain a 2% inflation target,
What that ultimately means is you're running monetary policy too tight for the consumers and businesses trapped on the bottom part of the K. And the big issue with that is we can very clearly see this in the mortgage market and in the credit market. If you look at the refinancing risk we see in the mortgage market, right now it's about 151 basis points. So that is the spread between the yield on the mortgage-backed security index and the coupon of the mortgage-backed security index. So every day we've gone forward in time since about early 2022, borrowers in the mortgage market have refinanced and or into higher interest rate regimes. And that's been persistent for, what, 3-4 years now. And so the issue is that if the Fed continues to maintain this kind of structurally tight monetary policy because they're hyper-focused on this arbitrary 2% inflation target, ultimately we're not getting the kind of credit relief to the consumers and businesses trapped on the bottom part of the K. It's the same in the credit market as well. In terms of the refinancing risk, it's been persistently positive for years now. And so this is an economy that sort of like, fiscal dominance is essentially an economy whereby it can't go into recession because of fiscal dominance. But the flip side of that positive outcome, the negative side of that outcome is that we have these, very K-shaped outcomes. There's just not enough money going to consumers and businesses at the bottom part of the K. And that's why interest rates are so high. There's just the treasury is too big. It's gobbling up too much capital. And so if the Fed doesn't play ball in terms of making that process easier to digest for financial markets, then there won't be any capital left to get to the consumers and businesses on the bottom part of K, which is why these interest rates are so high. And so
Darius, does that mean, in terms of attracting foreign capital or domestic capital to the bond market, does that mean, a higher term premium?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Number one. And secondly, is there potential for the Fed under fiscal dominance to cave in and not necessarily institute lots of rate cuts, but quantitative easing of some kind, printing money again?
Yield curve control is highly likely outcome.
Yeah.
Now here's the problem.
Yes.
Yeah. We're going to wind up there. There is a smart path or a stupid path. The Jay Powell Fed is on the stupid path, which is bury my head in the sand, maintain a 2% inflation target in an economy that very clearly wants to have 3% inflation, and keep my policy too tight so that people at the bottom part of the K don't get to participate in the economy. And there's no growth for them. They're in a recession. They've been in a recession for years. Pull up a chart of the small caps. Look at a chart of small caps relative to mega caps. Look at a chart of value relative to growth stocks. It's like a 5-year trend down. These factors in the market are telling you that every day we go forward in time, someone on the bottom part of the K is falling out of the economy. Like if I throw a stat at you, if you look at the share of job creation that is from non-government and government adjacent industries, so that's obviously federal, state, local government, healthcare, social services, those industries, those sectors within the jobs report, they accounted for 73% of total job growth in the last 2 years of the Biden presidency. They've accounted for 81% of total job growth in the first 6-7 months of the Trump presidency. There's hardly any growth in the private economy, particularly for the consumers and businesses on the bottom part of K. We know that the small businesses create all the jobs. And so if we don't give them any capital because the Fed is not playing ball because they're so myopically focused on 2% inflation, then we're going to have essentially a perma recession for the consumers and businesses on the bottom part of the K and a perma expansion for the consumers and businesses on top because they can finance in bond markets. They can extend the duration of their credit. They don't even need credit. You think a Mag 7 company needs debt? Of course not. They don't. So, Rick, we have this ridiculous...
That 1% spread between... is it R-star we're talking about?
So
the 1% spread between the 3% inflation rate that we're actually running at and the Fed's target of 1% and the Fed's target of 2% is what's ultimately causing all this disequilibrium.
Yeah, it's essentially. Exactly. Well, it's not what's causing the disequilibrium. It's that we are in a fiscal dominance regime now and have been since COVID. Now, it's not the Fed's fault.
So they're fighting it.
They're fighting it.
Yeah.
Fighting it. And the problem with fighting it is you're going to end up with too tight monetary policy for 2/3 of the consumers and businesses in the country.
For much too long.
Is it just antiquated thinking? Is that the only thing? Is that just habit, this 2% number that's been arbitrarily handed down, and Powell's legacy issue with trying to look like Volcker? Is that Is that the thing?
This is why I'm so passionate and angry about it, because to me, what I see observing is obviously someone who does hundreds of slides of research every week, thousands, really every week. Here's my take, and I may be wrong, but by what I'm interpreting is there's a guy who is, no offense to anyone who's in their 70s or 80s or 90s, there's a guy who's 72 years old that wants to retire as someone who did not let the inflation genie permanently out of the bottle. But the reality is, sorry, pal, you just had to be the guy. You know, like, you're sorry. But if we want to move, and this is where I'm trying to land the plane on the shifting from the stupid path, which is I want to myopically focus on 2% inflation because of my legacy. I'm going to sacrifice, you know, 2/3 of the country from a consumer and business standpoint. Screw them. It's about my legacy. As opposed to the smart path would be to change the way the Fed thinks about all this. We have real credible sources, not named Darius Dale, that are calling for regime change at the Federal Reserve. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent has been very adamant about this. Fed Governor nominee Steve Moran has been very adamant about this, written white papers on the same subject. Fed Chair candidate Kevin Warsh has run the ball right up the middle on this subject. Obviously, Fed Board nominee Judy Shelton has been beating this drum for years. You know, I'm not alone. Increasingly, who will be alone are these people, the people who are defending the legacy institution and the legacy of 2% inflation targeting. To me, that by the end of this presidency, the Trump presidency, the Fed will not have a 2% inflation target. The economy will probably be in some very severe recession if that's the case. So in our opinion, let's do what we need to do from an economic signaling perspective. Let's say what we need to say, and let's ultimately do the right research to guide us to a smooth transition from arbitrary 2% inflation to acknowledging fiscal dominance and the fact that the treasury market is in charge now. It's like that movie with Tom Hanks on the boat. It's like, you know, I'm in charge now. Like this treasury market telling Jay, hey, Jay, I'm in charge now. You need to figure it out.
Yeah. I mean, I think this would be an interesting point of debate if we had more time, but I don't want to derail it either. Like, because I think most people are going to, here's what's going to play out. I'd say continue on how you see things playing. And actually, we don't disagree on how things are going to play out. We think it's an interesting conversation about how it'll affect those at different parts of the income and wealth spectrum, but that's a sidebar. So definitely continue.
Yeah, well, so my theory on how it's all going to play out is that they are slowly going to put people on the Fed board that have different viewpoints, that think about the economy and asset markets differently than the economists that are currently there. I don't know what they're doing.
Agreed.
They made 5 major policy mistakes since Powell took over. They were too late to stop tightening in 2018. They were too slow to ease in 2020. They were too slow to tighten in 2021. They were asleep with the bank supervision will in 2023. In our opinion, they're too slow to ease here in 2025. You know, we're in the worst part of the U-shaped economy right now. We've been calling for the economy to U specifically. Hey, you need to be bullish because we're not going to L or I, we're going to U and bottom and start to go back up again. But we are currently in the worst part of the U-shaped economy. And so from a perspective of asset markets and perspective of the economy, a Fed that allows policy to tighten in this period as a function of not supplying the rate cuts that are already priced in, or worse, starting to signal that it's incrementally concerned about inflation, which is what Powell might do just to preserve his legacy in the coming months, because we know inflation is going to go up. It's already starting to go up. Boy, that would be a huge policy mistake in the context of, one, preserving the business cycle, which I think is more important than some random 2% inflation target. And I think a lot of folks agree with me. And more importantly, just setting good monetary policy for the economy. That's the most important.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think we agree that he's going to be replaced. Many other members of the committee are going to be replaced. And the committee is going to have a very different personality and a very different mandate in the next few quarters, for sure.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So, yeah, again, this is not an acute risk for financial markets, but from a long-term perspective, so you think about 12 to 18 months, we think that a lot of what we're talking about today will be front page news within the next 12 to 18 months. And so you have to position for that as investors.
Yeah.
You know, you want to position for, what was that, Byron Wien, something on page 16 that winds up on page 1?
Yeah.
I'm telling you what's on page 16 right now. That eventually in the coming quarters or coming years, it'll be on page 1. And
as the Fed starts to engage in the change
and they start to embrace
what you're saying is on page 16. Let's walk that forward and walk it through the markets and how it impacts things.
Yeah, what does that look like? What is there any sectors or styles that stand out or that stand to benefit from this policy mix?
Yeah, so it very clearly favors international, because ultimately what it means is you're probably talking about a dollar that's much lower in price than it is currently. Where's my dollar chart here? I'm scrolling aimlessly. My apologies. Great TV. Oh, here it is. And so if you see the dot, so what I'm showing in this chart here is the blue line represents the amount of rate cuts priced in from the current Fed funds rate to the floor Fed funds rate. It's about 134 basis points. So it's called, you know, 5 rate cuts. The red line is the 10-year nominal treasury yield, and the green line is a U.S. dollar index. Prior to Liberation Day, these were essentially the same time series. You know, for years, they were the same time series. But since Liberation Day, you've seen a gap emerge between interest rate pricing on both the short and long end of the curve and the dollar. In my opinion, I think that's the currency market starting a front-run regime change of the Fed. And so ultimately, we think there's if we're correct on this view, there's a tremendous amount of downside risk to the dollar over the long term for a variety of reasons. You're talking about lower real policy rates. You're talking about increasing the concentration of issuance on the short end of the treasury curve. And so what that ultimately means is that, you know, foreign creditors are going to have increasing opportunities to rehedge and rehedge and rehedge their positions more so than normal. And so you're probably talking about a durably low U.S. Dollar. And so what does that mean from a sectoral standpoint? If we look at S&P sectors, you know, the biggest sectors in the index are the ones that get paid the most from declining dollars. Technology is 56% of its revenues come from abroad. Materials is 52%, and the communication services is 49%. But these numbers are going up. As the dollar goes down, the share is going to go up because the foreign revenues will be growing faster than the domestic revenues. Or maybe not faster, but the delta will be faster. I think you think about your sector allocations from that perspective. You think about your international allocations from the return of EM. How many times in my career, almost two decades now, the people have been banging the table on EM. EM peaked at 2011, pretty early into my career. And it's just been a one-way trade down relative to the NASDAQ or S&P 500 for most of my career. I think you can start to credibly invest in EM again. Maybe not a broad basket EM, but certainly any EM with a positive story that's tethered to any AI super cycle or, you know, long-term productivity growth trend. I would highly recommend, any sort of long-term investors be thinking about that. But that's the kind of advice that I'm giving to institutional investors. You guys know that when I talk to retail investors, the number one thing I tell them to stop doing is to stop taking factor risks. If you're a retail investor, listen to me talk. Hey, you retail investor, stop taking factor risk in your portfolio. You're not getting paid to take factor risk. You're just winging it. That's how we built our KISS model portfolio solution to keep investors, retail investors, you know, collecting the beta that the markets are supplying to them to take advantage of, you know, long-term productivity growth trends, to take advantage of financial repression, to take advantage of monetary debasement, the kinds of things you tend to see in spades during a fourth turning. KISS is expressly positioned to take advantage of that with allocations to stocks, gold, and Bitcoin. I don't think you need to make it more complicated than that as an investor. If you do, you know, take a sliver of your portfolio and wing it and trade it around and get super active and pick sectors and stocks if it makes you sound smart on the golf course. But the reality is your job as a retail investor is not to sound smart on the golf course. It's to retire on time and comfortably. And the best way to do that is to collect the beta that the index is providing and that taking advantage of the big risks in markets that the market gods are providing.
So let's start with stocks, the stocks part of that KISS portfolio. Presumably, given your views, you'd orient more towards global, or are you still sticking with a domestic bet on that?
I'm still sticking with the domestic bet. I mean, I don't think you're going to find better companies than the ones that exist in the S&P 100. You might have a transitory period of time whereby on a raw basis, you know, you have some outperformance in international equities or emerging market equities. But the reality is, who's going to win the AI race? Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm asking you guys.
We are the U.S. The U.S. is safe.
It's probably going to be in the U.S.
But yeah. if you look at the policies this administration is putting in line, the deregulation across the board in order to enable a massive AI rollout and enableization, we're talking about the great New Deal level stuff here.
Totally.
So it's not only that, when you can't control the currency anymore due to the regime that you're in and due to the hegemonic losses in a multipolar world, control the platform. Make sure that you own the digital space and make sure you own the platform when you can't control the currency. And Europe's not going to do that. Japan's not going to do that. And China's a closed capital system. So the way it's set up in the U.S. is to dominate there. And then I love the way you're doing this. You know, you can get your EM exposure because your EM and international exposure is largely a currency deal.
Yeah.
So hedge with Bitcoin, hedge with gold. It acts as a currency hedge as well. And you can keep your home country bias, beautiful technology in what is the country that is leading the way in all of this.
Mike. You might be doing institutional sales soon, man. that's one of the most brilliant things I've heard all year, because we have a large amount of clients, our retail investor customers around the world, that are begging me to change the allocation in KISS on a near daily basis. Oh, small caps, international, emerging markets. It's like small caps, international, emerging markets. Like every week, it's like a new someone begging for this. And I keep telling them, like, look, you don't realize the risk you're taking when you request those things. There's no point in being long small caps when you can be long Bitcoin. There's no point in being long in that emerging markets or international, you can be long gold, because they're just currency plays. These are just currency plays. But this is stocks is productivity and innovation. Gold is financial repression. Bitcoin is monetary debasement. Those are the risks you need to outrun in your portfolio. Not who is it US or emerging markets outperforming. It's not small caps or large caps. That you don't need to take factor risk, retail investors. What you need to do is make sure that you're collecting the beta from these three main risks out there in a way that institutional investors can't. Institutional investors can't be long the stock market. They can't be long a lot of Bitcoin. They can't be long a lot of gold. At least I know quite a few incremental. Actually, we have two of our big buy-side clients have now allocated to gold in their core holdings now. So we've convinced two very large funds to allocate to gold. You can pretty much guess who they are just by Googling it. But so they can increasingly, but not to the same degree that a retail investor can. So if you heard anything I said today, if you're a retail investor, it's to stop taking factor risk and just give yourself the opportunity to collect the beta. Like what KISS is like you're walking with a basket. And when you're in a risk-on market regime, the basket is open and you're collecting the mana from the heavens. And then we're in a risk-off market regime. At the beginning of that, the basket closes and you go back into your tent. And when we go back into a risk-on market regime, KISS opens the basket again. You walk around and you collect the mana from the heavens. Institutional investors can't do that. They have to grab both two manas and say, this one's going to outperform that mana while they're getting wet, you know, while there's a bear chasing them. You know, like you don't need to make all these hard decisions that you're not getting paid to do in your portfolio. Just walk around with your basket when it's sunny, collect the mana from the heavens and close the basket when it's time to curve the basket. It's it. It's just that investing is that simple.
We manage a product that's return stack stocks, US stocks, gold and Bitcoin. And the gold and Bitcoin is risk weighted, and we stack the gold and Bitcoin on top of the US stocks.
Love that.
Each dollar of US stocks. Yeah.
So you have 200% exposure?
Correct.
Yeah.
So a dollar of stocks plus a dollar of an equal weight portfolio of gold and Bitcoin.
Equal risk weight.
Equal risk weighted portfolio. So it's about 4-1 now. And we update that on a sort of 500-day rolling basis. So as Bitcoin should contract in its volatility, then it's going to get a bigger weight vis-a-vis gold. You don't want the maniacs running the asylum, you know, so you don't want to do equal dollar weight.
Yeah.
And it really speaks to the KISS portfolio. And we talk about this often. It's a currency play, your international equities. You don't have to do it. And the core innovation, what's going to happen? The administration is telling you what it's going to do. And then it's doing it. This has been the most clear, concise implementation of things that they're going to do that I've ever seen in a government.
Yeah.
And people,
now, the problem is a lot. So people are getting frustrated because they can't keep up with it.
Right.
But the reality is they actually have been very concise and very core. You know, they actually have, yeah. It's just a lot of work to keep up with it.
Exactly.
So, Darius, what else is on page 16? Yeah. Anything come to mind?
This is on page 16 that we have time to talk about today. Mm. Probably nothing. I mean, the most important thing people should take away from this interview are two things. One, stop taking factor risks as a retail investor. Just give yourself exposure to productivity growth. Outrun financial repression and monetary debasement. That's what you should be doing to retire on time and come to live. That's number one.
And number two, we're probably going to get a lot more of the two of the latter, financial pressure and monetary debasement, because we're in a fiscal dominance regime and the Fed is the only institution in the world that can offset the growing supply demand imbalance of the treasury bond market. So that's the summary of this interview. And so going back to KISS, like, you know, one of the things that we think is, you know, if I do say so myself, ingenious about the process is, you know, because we're in this, you know, four-turning regime, one of the things that we learned from our four-turning investment during a four-turning regime study, we did a deep dive empirical analysis across, you know, I was probably like 50-something indicators to figure out, okay, how does the economy, how does policy, fiscal and monetary, and ultimately how does geopolitics evolve during four turns? And one of the key takeaways from that is we tend to see faster asset price appreciation with more volatility and bigger drawdowns. Isn't that not what we've experienced since the GFC? We've had four crashes since 2018. We had four crashes in the two decades prior. Every year since 2015, the market has either gone up 20% intra-year or down 20% intra-year. Every year. It's exactly what you should be expecting. And so ultimately, we're moving towards this. I think we've already crossed the point of no return when we went into COVID in terms of fiscal dominance. And ultimately, now we're stuck in fiscal dominance. And now here are all the options to deal with fiscal dominance. You can cut, you can grow, you can print. I think we have a high probability of not cutting our way out of it based on what we observed in April. And so they're either going to grow their way out of it, print their way out of it. Paradigm C is the administration's attempt to grow their way out of it. You don't want to be bearish and stand on the wrong side of that. It's ultimately going to fail. 3-5 years from now, it'll fail. It's not going to work. And then they'll be in the print phase. And the print phase is kind of the end phase of all this stuff. And this is not just in U.S. history. This is across many different societies. And so that's where we're headed. And so you have to position your portfolio if you want to retire on time and comfortably to outrun these risks. And if you're not out, you don't need to position your portfolio to outperform with the small caps versus mega caps or EM versus U.S. That's stupid. What's smart is outrun these risks, these big structural forces.
Yeah. So the idea is that during the grow your way out of it phase, which we're currently in, presumably equities are kind of the primary growth engine, right? You don't really know when the growth phase transitions to the print phase. And so you want to have that, those positions on in gold and Bitcoin, et cetera, in order to hedge against that, you know, coming risk at some point. Obviously, they're paying off nicely now. They have paid off over the last year and a half, 2 years, especially Bitcoin, obviously for much longer. But owning them all in the portfolio allows you to capitalize from the growth phase as long as it lasts and hedge against the print phase when it eventually arrives.
100%. And Adam, you said something that I thought was so important. And I really want to highlight it, which is you don't know.
Yeah.
You don't know. I don't know. No one knows when this stuff's going to transition.
Yeah.
You don't know. We came into the year with a highly convicted view that the administration was taking us to paradigm B and they were going to kitchen sink the economy and asset markets. And that obviously turned out to be true for a month and a half. But how could we possibly have known that the bond market would force them to pivot to paradigm C so quickly? There's no way you could know this stuff. And so this is why KISS does what it does. The KISS is not a static pie chart of 60, 30, 10 stocks, gold, Bitcoin. The exposures to stocks, gold, and Bitcoin are dynamic, independently dynamic. And they're based on what we call our top-down risk management overlay and our bottom-up risk management overlay. The top-down risk management overlay incorporates vol targeting into the strategy. The bottom risk management overlay incorporates dynamic position sizing into the strategy. So, for example, if we go into a, you know, risk-off market regime, the target allocations for, you know, stocks and Bitcoin will decline. If we go, if those particular exposures start to break down from the perspective of their own volatility, just a momentum signal, then the dynamic position sizing associated with them to decline. So there's sort of like much like a pod shop would have in terms of its master risk management system and the risk management that the PMs implement on their own. That's where we got the idea from in terms of having two layers of risk management. And so ultimately, what this does for me, my clients, I use this to manage my entire liquid network, is relative to a naked long portfolio of 60, 30, 10 stocks, gold, and Bitcoin. So that's just always long 60, 30, 10 stocks, gold, Bitcoin with no dynamic position sizing or vol targeting. KISS has a 90% upside capture ratio and 50% downside capture ratio. So you're getting 90% of the return you would get as an investor naked long participating in these risks with only half of the downside.
That'd be
obviously relative to 60-40, it's 250% upside capture ratio with a 50% downside capture ratio. So relative to 60-40, it blows it out of the water. So this is why I continue to pound the table on. I have not seen a better mousetrap, no offense to you guys, I really mean this, for helping retail investors retire on time and comfortably. Because as much as I think you guys invented a very ingenious mousetrap yourself, one of the things that I think you would agree, anyone above the age of 50 is going to struggle with having a 200% position in stocks go with Bitcoin that doesn't raise cap when it's time to raise cap.
No, to be fair, those are more tools for advisors to be employing in their books of business. So we're not selling it as a solution. So this is an EAA app type thing.
It is a solution. I think it's a genius solution.
Right.
Quite frankly, it's a better solution than most of the things that advisors are plugging into their client allocations, which is 60-40 or 70-30 or some other ridiculous.
What I'm wondering, which is maybe the subject for another day or a follow-up call, is if there's an opportunity to run KISS in something that's return stacked and have this dynamic on it, and whether you've thought about engaging anybody on that topic and turning this into a democratization and maybe launching an ETF.
Like you're 6 months too late, my friend. Less than the ETF suit. So.
Oh, good for you. Congratulations.
Yep. That's great. Yeah.
And congratulations. Sorry, Darius, just final question. I want to ask you, what's the reaction you get when you're out there pounding your fist on the KISS model portfolio and the simplicity of it? You know, what's the reaction you're getting initially? Do people look at you with consternation, like really just equities, gold, Bitcoin, that's it?
Yeah, I don't know if you guys can see this, but my response to the reactions, I just point everybody to our testimonials page. There's hundreds of testimonials from 42 macro customers telling them about how KISS has solved every problem that they've ever had investing for decades.
Yeah.
And so I generally don't get into lengthy conversations about, you know, is this a good solution? Because A, it's obviously a very good solution. And B, you don't need to take my word for it. Take their word for it.
Yeah.
Literally hundreds of testimonials telling you, I just click on a random one. You're an insurance policy. This is too comprehensive, as succinct as it gets. You know, this is exactly what I'm talking about. So like, I point people to our customers and what they say about us and not what I say about us. Who cares what I say?
Right.
You know what I mean, I can tell you any financial snake oil salesman can get on a podcast and just tell you a bunch of stuff. What you should care about is what does that person's customer say about them. And so that's why I point into this. But I think answer your question.
Well, that's perfect. Yeah.
But I didn't really answer your question. Answer your question more specifically, you know, for people who are reserved about KISS, this is what I tell them. Hey, look, you don't have to jump into KISS with two full feet. If you're just, you don't trust me or trust KISS yet, like you probably should, then just do it with a sliver of your portfolio. Do it half your portfolio or your whole portfolio. Yep. Keep doing what you were doing with the other 50% and start with the 50% in KISS.
Yeah.
And then check on it in a year. And I guarantee you, KISS will have better raw and risk-adjusted returns in a year. I don't think there's too many retail investors that are going to beat me on both a raw and risk-adjusted return basis after a year. Maybe you might get me on raw if you're making long a bunch of, you know, high beta crypto crap that goes up in a bull market, but I guarantee you won't beat me on risk adjusted if we go into a bear market. So promise to our clients forever.
Amazing, amazing, Darius. The proof of the pudding is in the eating.
Yeah. My entire liquid net worth is following KISS. I will have one position. When that ETF comes out, I will have one position in my account until I retire. Think about that. One ETF in my account until I retire, and I'm 38 years old.
Simple is a beautiful thing.
Amen.
Yeah.
No, this is great, man.
The reason I had to ask you, Darius, because, you know, it's like Einstein's quote, you know, make it simple, but not too simple. You know, make things as simple as possible, but what's the quote? Simplify, but no simpler. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think it's so simple that's what complicates, you know, people's thinking, which is it can't be that simple.
No.
Right.
Well, we tell investors they get out of bed thinking they got to outperform this or that. It's like, who told you to do that? You're not getting paid to do that. Just take advantage of the risks. Take out your basket, collect the mana from the heavens during the daylight. And when it's dark and there's no mana for, and go back into your tent.
Yeah.
There's a lot of fun stuff to do in a tent at night, by the way.
you don't need to bang bang.
I think to put some words around that too is the mandate flexibility and portfolio agility that retail investors have are significant advantages over institutional clients. And this is something that Adam coined this phrase, not me. I'm stealing from Adam. But being able to have that agility and flexibility in your mandate to be able to be largely in cash or out of the market when it's raining, and be able to open up the basket during the good times, and then diversifying those assets in a thoughtful way when it is raining nirvana from heaven, those are the leverage points where the small investor has real advantage over very large investors. Bridgewater's not going to be able to move out of stocks in their entire portfolio. They're not going to be able to do it. That's that portfolio agility. And the boards of pensions and endowments won't allow them the mandate flexibility to do it either. And this is what retail investors should really take.
But it's not going to be as effective, right?
Yeah. That's exactly right. They hedge, but it's never the same.
Totally.
No, I agree with you. I completely agree. And again, we've clients across the entire investing spectrum. On a cumulative basis, our BuySky clients manage more than $25 trillion in AUM. You add up all their AUMs, their published AUMs. And so when I have those conversations, it's about picking factors. Which factors are going to outperform? What's the market going to do over short to medium term time horizon? Which factors are going to outperform? Which factors are going to underperform? How can I stay ahead of the factor rotation, risk management signal at the mothership? When I talk to retail investors, it's stop taking factor risks, stop trying to trade every wiggle in the market, and use your basket to your advantage. And that's to your point, the flexibility and the agility. That's the basket. You can open and close the basket when there's mana to be poured into the basket or where there's no mana to be poured into the basket. Institutional investors have a very different mandate. Very different mandate. And so, I'm grateful to be kind of at the nexus of, these two very different mandates, because I think we're creating a lot of value for our institutional clients, and we're also creating equal, if not more, amount of value for our retail clients. I mean, I'm probably a dime a dozen to an average institutional PM, but I guarantee you that nobody in retail land has seen institutional grade macro risk management to this degree for, $50 to $75 a month, I guarantee.
So we're coming up on a little bit of time limits. I know you had some time constraints.
Yeah.
But I want just one last question. In the whole sort of the idea, like, looks to me like the Robin Hooders are in on this rally. Like those smaller investors, they bought in, they bought the dip, they're in. The mahogany desk money, the institutional money, sings,
My desk is mahogany.
Yeah, right? I know, but I don't mean you. Mahogany desk money seems to be a little bit underinvested. Are you seeing that with your clients as you talk to those folks? Have they been caught a little bit offside in this recovery and new highs, or are they kind of participating?
They were in early June, less so by late June.
Okay.
I would say the folks who probably listened to me the most were already there by early May. The folks where I'm just kind of like a fly. I'm just a sell side guy. I'm meeting 1 p.m. There's going to be another sell side guy at 3 p.m. If I'm to one of those funds, I noticed the change in their tone and sentiment starting in kind of early to mid June. But again, I don't have to answer this with inside baseball. We have a positioning model that can, that we track. In fact, let me just show that real quick before we go off our positioning model. So we can see in our positioning model that, investors are more exposed to the market than they had been, throughout. So one of the things we track what the positioning model is, we track 16 different long-term time series that all proxy the positioning across different cohorts for different participants in the market. So like retail investors, RIA, so on and so forth, market neutral funds, et cetera. And what we're trying to do is identify, okay, what's the median value of each time series observed at major bull market peaks? What's the median value observed in each time series at major bear market troughs, and which time series are currently breaching those thresholds? And so for the ones that correspond to the short to medium term time horizon, one of them is currently breaching the threshold, which is the name stock allocation survey, which we use to proxy active, kind of long only active manager exposure. So they're more involved in the participating in the market. And then we use the AI stock allocation, the bond allocation, and cash allocation survey to proxy investment advisors. We use realized volatility to proxy systematic hedge funds. We use 3 month implied vol correlations to proxy market neutral hedge fund gross exposure. Now we use obviously the valuation of the market, credit spreads, and economic policy uncertainty. These are all time series that back test very well in terms of creating a high degree of dispersion between bull market peaks and bull market troughs. And there's a lot more red now today than there was at any point in the last 3 to 4 months. And this is relatively new. In the last couple of weeks, we're starting to see a lot more red lights show up. And so the thing was beat red in February, by the way.
Yeah.
And so you have to think, okay, we're getting a little bit to a point in the positioning cycle whereby if we don't start to see policy support, from a monetary policy standpoint, that you could go into a period of chop as we get into the worst part of the U-shaped economy, which we've been calling for. Not necessarily calling for the chop, we're just saying, hey, the economy is going to U, we're in the worst part of the U. It would be helpful if our friend Jay Powell can avoid making another policy mistake and start to supply the rate cuts that the economy and markets need. But if they don't, then we will probably correct.
Yeah, and the bigger money has caught up. So that easy lift that was behind, so I'm updating my priors, that easy lift is there. And so we're getting to that fully invested portion where we may see a little chop in a September-October period, which is a great time to allow you to catch up if you're under-allocated and so on.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Well, this has been great, man. I love talking with you guys, man. You guys are geeks, Barry, a fun geek. Yeah. I love a fun nerd, man. That's a high compliment.
All right, my man.
Darius, this has been phenomenal. Thank you so much.
No, I appreciate you guys. You guys
always awesome, man. Great to see you again.
Dear buddy.
Yeah. Awesome.